Nacho Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of the Calcio Land podcast. So today we have a couple of things planned. We're going to take an in-depth look at Italy's match against Sweden. We're recording this on Thursday. They're going to play the first leg in Sweden tomorrow, so we'll get a lot into that. I'm also going to have my colleague from Di Marzio site, Paolo Mangone, come on and get his take. He's a huge fan of Italy. We have some great questions from you guys. You guys keep impressing us with what you send in. And then we're going to close with Ben Golliver, sports writer for Sports Illustrated, covers the NBA. The reason we have him on, and he's been on the podcast before, is for the many aspiring and up-and-coming writers that we have listening to us. He really has an amazing story to tell. We recorded this interview on Monday. He really shared some great tips. So if you're interested in journalism, learning about writing, reporting, all that good stuff, definitely check that out. At the end, I also asked him some questions on the NBA. I know quite a few of you listening also enjoy the NBA, so I think you'll really like his takes. But before we get to that, I am joined by our great co-host and producer, Alex Goldberg. And Alex, you know, this has been the week of Pirlo's retirement, so I wanted to get your take. When you hear the words Andrea Pirlo, what comes to mind to you?
I think of the Dos Equis, most interesting man in the world. I mean, maybe that's just because he loves wine. He just seems like a classy individual. If I was a woman, maybe he'd be my dreamboat. But no, in reality, his free kicks, David, his free kicks are just stupendous. Some people have signature free kicks. One of my favorite free kick takers was Alex, the Brazilian center back, who would just stand 20 yards behind it and barrel it through. But there's nobody more inch perfect than Andrea Pirlo with his free kicks. As you know, David, I became a big Paul Pogba fan until he went to Manchester United. But I was illegally streaming all those Juventus games when Conte was just starting to give Pogba a chance. And I feel like he was able to get such a big chance because he had Pirlo next to him. Pirlo just so calm, so composed. But most of all, the signature Andrea Pirlo moment is a free kick going in the top corner. So that's me. What about you?
So, you know, it's funny you mentioned the free kicks, which of course is, you know, makes a lot of sense. But, you know, I always think about his sense of humor, which is maybe something that a lot of our listeners might not be that familiar with. He's always been a really funny guy. In his great autobiography book, there's a lot of stories on all the pranks he pulled on Gattuso and other teammates over the years. When Gattuso was negotiating a contract extension with Milan, Pirlo would steal his cell phone, send text messages to Braida, who was the director, along with Galliani. And in one of them, he wrote, you know, if you give me what I want and the contract extension, you can have my sister. And Gattuso got furious over that. Pirlo and De Rossi were always pulling pranks on him on the Italian national team retreats. One story in his book that really cracked me up is they hid in his room at Coverciano, like waited an hour for him to fall asleep. Pirlo was under his bed, De Rossi in the closet, and then they surprised him and they scared the crap out of him. So I really enjoy those stories. When I met him in person a few times in New York City for games down there, he was always cracking jokes, was really, really funny with the people around him, the Italian press. The other thing, though, that I wanted to say is, you know, I've been reading a lot of takes on Pirlo, and, you know, it seems, you know, it's very divided. He's become, like, much more of a Juve icon in recent years. And, you know, to me, that's a little bit of a shame. Of course, he was great at Juve, but when I think of Pirlo's, you know, career, he won the Champions League with Milan. When Italy won the World Cup, he was a Milan player. So, you know, to see the reaction from a lot of Milan fans towards Pirlo, you know, it's not even really a matter of who's right or wrong, you know, because I get some of the parts of his book on Milan aren't particularly flattering. But, you know, I find it maybe a little bit of a shame. You know, I think, you know, there's a lot of, I don't know if you've ever had this, Alex, you know, you dump your girlfriend. She's not, you know, you feel like you're better than her and you can do better. And then the minute you dump her, she loses a little bit of weight, becomes really attractive, maybe gets a new great haircut, and then she starts dating the person that you hate the most. I feel like there's maybe a little bit of that with Milan fans towards Pirlo. You know, I have a feeling that had he not gone to Juve and not won, you know, Scudetti there, maybe there wouldn't be these sort of takes on him. But again, I get it. I definitely think Pirlo maybe could have done a little bit more to manage how he's perceived by Milan fans. But for me, my takeaway is just a little bit sad. You know, I see Kaká, who's completely idolized from Milan fans. And Kaká left Milan when Milan was still Milan to go play for Real Madrid. In the book, you know, Pirlo writes about how much he wanted to go play for Real Madrid and they had a contract ready, but he didn't go. You know, Milan asked him, look, you know, please stay, we need you, and he did. And Kaká, on the other hand, left, and he's an idol with Milan fans. And I get that Kaká's been managing, you know, the way he's perceived with Milan fans a lot better, writes great tweets about him. I don't doubt that he loves Milan, but to me, actions speak louder than words. Pirlo only left Milan when they wouldn't really extend his contract beyond a one-year deal. He had lost his role under Allegri. They wanted to change his position. He wasn't guaranteed to be a starter. Juve offered him a three-year deal, told him they were going to make him a central part of the team. You can't blame him for leaving, at least in my opinion. So for me, it's just a shame. Again, I get the reaction from fans, and, you know, I respect that. I just think, you know, it's kind of a shame because to me, Pirlo should also be celebrated, and probably mainly for what he did at Milan. So that's enough with that rant. So we want to start previewing tomorrow's big match against Sweden. So we have some great questions, and I'm going to chat with my colleague from the Marzo side, Paolo Mangone, in a little bit, but I figured a great place to start was get a prediction from our Oracle Thousand Names. I asked him yesterday to send us a prediction for tomorrow's match, and he has it as 0-0. The comment is Ventura strategy and schemes produce absolutely nothing. He says as a result, there's a desire to see more of Eder on the national team, and he says the BBC is sad to watch. So that's Thousand's prediction. Interestingly, we had Nima Tavallier on Monday, who gave us a great breakdown on Sweden. If you missed it, definitely check it out. He also predicted this match was going to be 0-0, and then everything would be decided at San Siro on Monday. And you know what? I'm going to be a little bit bolder, and I'm going to give Italy a chance, and I'm going to say they're going to win 1-0 tomorrow with a goal by Immobile. So that's a prediction from Thousand and mine. But now let's get to the great questions that you guys keep sending in with the CalcioLand hashtag. So which ones are we going to cover today, Alex?
All right, David, the first one. Do you think the Jorginho selection was a cynical way to have him tied to the Italian national team, or will Ventura actually use him?
So not surprisingly, Ventura said the decision wasn't political. Jorginho's agent said, look, you know, we picked Italy. We're not going to go to Brazil regardless. I have a feeling there's definitely a little bit of, the Federation, maybe Italian Federation, intervening a little bit. If, God forbid, Italy gets eliminated by Sweden, Ventura's going to be gone. And I think there's certainly part of the thinking is that it wouldn't be fair to Ventura's successor. Not only do you not go to the World Cup, but you also lose Jorginho to Brazil. So I have a feeling that was a little bit of a factor. As of now, it doesn't look like Jorginho is going to start at least tomorrow's match, so let's see. But I do think you can be a little bit cynical with that selection, in my opinion.
Okay, what formation would get the most out of this Italy squad?
So instead of answering this, I'm going to rant on the fact that I think it's absolutely insane that going into this match, Ventura is all of a sudden switching back to the 3-5-2, the formation that Italy mainly used at the Euro, the signature one that Conte used more. You know, Ventura had all these months to get the team ready to get to the World Cup, and now that he has his back against the wall, he's changing it. You know, that 4-2-4 that he was playing was an absolute disaster for a variety of reasons. I find the fact that he hasn't figured out a formation that suits his best players, that gets most of Italy's best players on the pitch, is really a big problem. That's what a national team coach has to do, in my opinion. And the fact that in this formation that he's going in tomorrow, there's no room for Insigne, who, yeah, I get it. Like my friend Matteo Bonetti tweeted me, look, Insigne on Napoli is very different than on Italy, and I get that. But at the same time, you have to set up your best players to succeed on the national team. So I think it's a shame that going into this match, there's been a last-minute change. But I do think that for this particular situation, I get how this makes sense going for the 3-5-2.
Okay, what is Italy's best midfield now that Jorginho is in the squad?
So I would go probably with a trio of Jorginho, Verratti, and Pellegrini. Now, Pellegrini hasn't been selected for this match. I think for the most part, Ventura picked the players in a way that would give him the least amount of criticism, brought back Zaza, who unfortunately, as we're recording this, there's news that he won't be able to play. He re-injured his knee. That's a big problem. Belotti looks to be starting with Immobile. The two of them have a bit of experience playing together at Torino. But back to the midfield, I ideally would go with those three. I have a feeling we're going to see De Rossi and Verratti for sure tomorrow, so let's see how that goes. But I'd like to see if Italy, and I'm pretty confident they will make the World Cup, going with a trio of Pellegrini, Verratti, and Jorginho.
All right, but how about if Italy missed the World Cup? What would the fallout be?
I think it would be humongous. I mean, obviously Ventura would be gone. I would imagine the Federation President Tavecchio, who although has support from a lot of the big clubs, would also have to go. I mean, this would be disastrous. Italy has never missed the World Cup. Usually Italy in these big matches with a lot of pressure does well. So if they choke against a lesser opponent, that's without Ibrahimovic, I think there'd be a big shakeup at the Federation. I wouldn't be surprised if there would be a big push to try to have less foreign players in Serie A. It's hard to legislate that with the European Union, but I think you'd see maybe the rules tweaked even further for teams to be forced to have more homegrown or Italian players in the squad. So I do think the fallout would be huge. For those of you that listen to us here in the United States and you're seeing what's happened with the American Federation, I think it'd be worse in a lot of ways with the Italian one.
Yeah, not a good look here in the United States, that's for sure. All right, which breakthrough Italian young player do you see having the best shot at making Italy's World Cup squad if they qualify?
Sure. So we already mentioned Pellegrini, who I agree with John Solano, who's pumped him up a lot on a recent podcast. So I definitely would see Pellegrini in the midfield. And I would really like to see Federico Chiesa from Fiorentina. Granted, Italy has a good amount of options up front, but I think Chiesa would be a really good player to bring to Russia, even if you don't use him, just for him to soak up the experience at being at a World Cup, because I think after the World Cup, he's going to be a key player for Italy. So those are the two that I would go for.
All right, David, could Napoli midfielder Diawara play for Italy in the near future?
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about that. He's trying to get an Italian passport. I think that would be great. You know, it'd be interesting because Jorginho, who's now on the team, and Diarra alternate on Napoli. Jorginho plays, you know, I'd say 70% of the games, and Diarra, his caddy, plays about 30% of the time, so it'd be interesting to have them both on the national team. But I think Diarra, I think, is only 19, is an absolute beast. A midfield with him, Verratti, Jorginho, and then you throw in Gagliardini from Inter, Pellegrini. Like, all of a sudden, you have a really nice mix of young midfielders. So I think we could see that. I think Diarra and the Azzurri after the World Cup is certainly possible.
Okay, this one I'm a little interested in. What do you think Antonio Conte's approach would be should Chelsea not replace Michael Emenalo?
So I've read a lot of takes, and I don't have any inside knowledge on this. I'm going to try to find out after the podcast to try to find out more. I don't know how much truth there is to Conte pushing out Emenalo, that it was a win for him. I'm not so sure. I know he has, it seems there's a lot of reports, and I've been to some truth to it, some issues with Marina, you know, the woman, the right-hand woman to Abramovich. And from what I've read, it sounds like Emanalo then wanted to get in the middle of that. But what must be said is that Conte always likes to be very involved on the transfer market. I think we saw that more this summer with Chelsea getting Morata and Zappacosta, two players that he clearly pushed for. So I think you'll see him more and more involved with Chelsea. I think in the January transfer window, don't be surprised if Chelsea goes shopping in Italy or with players that Conte wants. So definitely Conte will always be involved, and he might be even more involved now.
I had to make an ick sound when you said Marina, because I actually think she is the true person responsible for all of Chelsea's lousy moves, but I'll move on. All right, David, what is the deal with Fabio Cannavaro coaching in China?
So I think this is because of his close relationship with Marcello Lippi. You know, Cannavaro was the captain on the Italian national team that won the World Cup. Of course, Marcello Lippi was the coach. And Lippi was really the pioneer of going to China, going there even before all the money was being spent there. And Cannavaro was always his sidekick going along there. And I think Cannavaro is, you know, trying to groom himself there. He's coached, you know, in the Middle East before, too. You know, I can't judge him as a coach. I can't say that I've seen any team that he's managed on the pitch. But the reason he's in China is his connection to Lippi. And Lippi, you know, his son's an agent. I think they really see a lot of potential for a lot of business ventures with players and whatnot. And maybe Cannavaro's part of that as well.
David, what did you make of Patrick Schick's recent interview? Were his comments inappropriate considering he's barely played at all for Roma? And under what circumstances could we see Morata back at Juve?
So the reason I asked you to put these together is because before I answer on Schick, I'm going to give you my take on interviews. I think it's always very important to pay attention where the interview was given and what nationality the media was that the player spoke to. Not necessarily because some nationalities are better than others, but I always think, you know, a player, it's only natural that you want to maybe tell the person something they want to hear a little bit. You know, Morata's comments on how much he loved Juve, never wanted to leave and whatnot. You know, that was made to the Italian press. What a surprise. And then, you know, some of the quotes got him in trouble a little bit with Chelsea fans, and he blamed it on a translation. So I always say, always pay attention where the interview's given. It's always very interesting how sometimes players or coaches will say something pretty radically different based on which media they're talking to. The other thing that I think is really important is a lot of times you just see the quote. You don't necessarily see the question that was being asked, and I think that was a lot with the Schick situation. And then never forget things that can get lost in translation. Sometimes there's loose translations, maybe to try to sell papers a little bit. So those are things that I would pay attention to. So as far as Schick's interview, for those that didn't see it, you know, he mentioned that someday, you know, he said that his whole career, making money has been a big motivator for him, and he's always trying to, you know, advance himself financially, which, you know, is pretty honest. I bet you a lot of players feel that way. It just always sounds a little awkward. And he said, you know, there are some bigger clubs that maybe could pay me more and give me more opportunities. And then the journalist pressed him and asked him which ones, and he mentioned, of course, Manchester United, Barcelona, and whatnot. So I think, you know, it wasn't a good look, especially because Schick's barely played for Roma. But, you know, I also think, you know, he's a young guy. I think he got a gotcha question and fell into the trap. I don't justify what he said, but, you know, maybe it wasn't as bad as it looked. The other, my advice, though, to any player, I doubt any high caliber one is listening, but my advice in general would be, if you're on a club that's in the Champions League, don't even talk about wanting to play for a bigger club. I think it's just going to come off really poorly. If you're on a mid-table team or a lower division team, I think it's fine to say that you aspire to play for a bigger club, but if you're at a club like Roma in the Champions League, it's just not a good look to say I want to play for other clubs. It reminds me of when Isla joined Juve and talked about going to Real Madrid. He hadn't even played a game yet. You know, maybe it was honest and there's some truth to that, but it's just a horrible look. As far as answering the question on Morata back to Juve, you know, I don't want to break your heart, Alex, but it wouldn't surprise me if down the road, I mean, won't be for a while, but it wouldn't surprise me if in 3-4 years that he goes back. You know, his wife is from Venice. It wouldn't shock me, but I think, you know, even if you read yesterday the interview that we tweeted on the Marta site, Morata again reassured that he's very happy at Chelsea. Not surprisingly, that wasn't an interview with the Italian press.
Whew. All right. Don't go anywhere just yet, Morata. Cesar Azpilicueta has a lot more balls to deliver to you. All right. Let's give Sampdoria some love. How long do you see their football plan working for? And is it just reliant on Marco Giampaolo staying?
It's a great question. So the football plan is, you know, playing this attractive style football. It was interesting when Sarri was asked which coach he likes in Italy. He mentioned Giampaolo, who not surprisingly is the one that replaced him at Empoli before he went to Samp. I think, you know, because Sampdoria's president, Ferrero, quite the character, is in the movie business, is all about entertainment. I think this taste of what he's seeing with Giampaolo, whenever Giampaolo wants to move to a bigger club, I think he's going to want to keep this going because he's getting a lot of good press off it. So I think it's not just contingent on Giampaolo. I think because Ferrero's there and loves entertainment, we might see more of this.
Is Kolarov the signing of the season so far? He seems to be having the same impact Dani Alves had at Juve, minus the baggage.
So I also wanted to include this question because, again, I laughed at all the Juve fans that dismissed Dani Alves' departure as not a big deal. It's him just having a couple of good Champions League matches. I haven't followed much PSG, but I saw a lot of sites have him on the team of the season so far. I'm so not surprised. I mean, that guy's a winner. So the loss of Dani Alves, I think Juve misses him too. I mean, granted he was playing more as a forward towards the end, but they could certainly use him at right back now. But that aside, Kolarov's been absolutely tremendous. I think if you look at it just as a value signing, I think he came for $5 million, bang for the buck. It's hard to do better now that Ghoulam's out with an injury. He's by far the best left back in Serie A until Alexandro gets back on track. I do think, though, if you consider age, and granted Inter spent over $20 million, Skriniar is still, to me, at least an equivalent signing to Kolarov because his value is just going to go up, and he's been absolutely sensational. But if you said Kolarov's the signing of the season, I really wouldn't argue with you either.
I think Alexandro just wants to go to Chelsea, and he's playing like crap because of that. All right, which Serie A teams do you expect to be the most active during the January window?
So we got this question last time, but there's been some movement a little bit. So, you know, Napoli, not surprisingly, is already active. We're starting to have transfer rumors on Di Marzio's site, which is great. So definitely check us out there. They're pursuing Versalco, who used to play for Sassuolo's at Atletico Madrid. Seems that right now Atletico Madrid doesn't want to sell him. Napoli is definitely a team to watch. Inter, I think, is definitely going to look for more depth. It wouldn't surprise me if João Mário, maybe they try to flip him to PSG for Pastore, maybe something like that. And Inter going for a defender and likely Ramirez, who plays for their parent, their owner's club in China. I always look at historically which clubs do a lot of business in January, and it's both clubs in Genova, so I expect a lot from Samp and Genoa in January.
David, what happens to Milan if they don't meet expectations? Do they sell the players and go for another reboot?
So, I say it all the time, I go out of my way not to speculate too much on Milan's future. I mean, I have my own opinions on the sale and all that, but, you know, I try to really stick to facts. So I always go back to the quote that Fassone said that, look, if we don't make the Champions League, we're going to have to sell one to two top players. So for me, you know, if God forbid they flop, they'll make the Champions League, and that, you know, at this moment, that's probably what's going to happen. I just don't know how realistic it is for them to spend a lot. If I hear them saying we have to sell one to two big names, that sounds like it's really more to balance the budget. The good news, if God forbid that happens, Milan smartly went for a lot of young players, you know, in the summer. So I think there's margin for growth for those players. Interestingly, today, Milan presented their plans to UEFA for financial fair play. Let's see how that goes. I think we'll have a better idea there. But until we know more facts, I'm not going to speculate too much on what will happen there. I'll stick to the quotes that Fassone made.
All right, last Twitter question. Realistically, can Lazio hold on to their best players in the coming seasons, or will they be picked apart like Monaco?
So this is a very good question. Now, you know, I always think, you know, we should always think of what's the business model for the clubs. You know, clubs like Juve, Milan, Inter, you know, they go for winning. Other clubs, you know, try to, you know, balance the book, find prospects, turn a profit. I think Lazio's kind of in the middle. They want to, you know, see what they can do if they can get to the Champions League, maybe be a little bit more aggressive, but they don't pay huge salaries. Like Immobile just recently extended his contract. He's been, in my opinion, the best player in Serie A this season. I think his new salary is 2.5 million euro net of taxes. And again, for those of you in England, this is net. In England, you guys report those wages gross, so big difference. But to give you a frame of reference, most starters at Juve, their best players, make at least 4 million. So, you know, if Immobile wanted to be paid like a top player, he'd have to leave. We'll see a lot about Lazio with what happens with De Vrij. His contract expires next June. They're working on an extension. So let's see if they can sign him to an extension and they make the Champions League. Maybe they try to keep the band together. I mean, I think Milinkovic-Savic will probably be sold because he's really getting ready to take the next step, and he could come back with a huge profit. And then Lazio's been good about reinvesting. I'm just not sure if their business model really allows them to think like Juve, Milan, and Inter. But if they make the Champions League, maybe it won't be like what we saw from Monaco. Okay, so to get another perspective on Italy's big match against Sweden, I couldn't think of a better person to have on than my colleague Paolo Mangone from Di Marzio's site. Because when I met him in person this summer in Boston, he was wearing a vintage Azzurri jersey. I think it was a Paolo Rossi one from the 82 World Cup. So that really told me everything I needed to know about how he feels about the Azzurri. So welcome back to Calcioland, Paolo. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, David. It's always a pleasure.
Awesome. So, Paolo, what I wanted to do is ask you some of the questions that I got. I answered, but on earlier in the podcast, I want to see what your take is on a couple of these. So the first one is, don't think so much of the players selected, but in an ideal world, now that Jorginho's in the mix, which midfield would you use with the Azzurri?
I thought about this, and normally for the national team, you're kind of forced to play out of position.
Yeah.
Especially after reading the Ibra interview yesterday from DeMarzio's website, and that Verratti is always the best as a defensive midfielder, but I still think that De Rossi is the best as the anchor man, and that Verratti and then Jorginho can play as the mezzala, because it would force other teams to man mark those Verratti and Jorginho, so make it harder for them to cover passes between the players.
Very, very interesting. So the next one that I have, and then we can save the ones you have for me for the end, is I was thinking a lot about this. Like, God forbid Italy gets eliminated from Sweden. You were in Italy not that long ago. You have some good perspective with that. What do you think the fallout would be for the federation, for calcio as a whole? What do you think would happen if, God forbid, they don't make it?
God forbid that Italy doesn't make it. The first thing on the list is Ventura will be fired. That is a guarantee. And then I was reading some articles is that the Italian Federation will lose out on a substantial prize money because they don't qualify for the mm-hmm. World Cup, so that will have a knock-on effect. And also the Italian press will be savaging the Federation and be demanding for some action. And I think that if they don't qualify, it will end up being like a Germany-style rebuild, like after they didn't qualify out of the group stage in the Euro 2004. And it will start from the youth academies. In Germany, they have to have a certain amount of youth players on their squad, and I think it will have to be the same thing for the Italian league as well.
Very, very interesting. And the last one that I have for you, you're an astute observer of even the mid-table teams and all, so I figure you're a great person for this. Which young Italian players do you think have the best shot of making the World Cup squad if they pass the round against Sweden, which I expect to happen? Which players do you think that maybe aren't on the squad now, which ones do you think have a chance?
Well, I'll name two. Federico Chiesa, because he starts on Fiorentina, and he's a wonder kid. I think he should have been on the team already. I think it's one of Ventura's failures of not calling him up. Another player is Caldara. I think he's the next up-and-coming center back, and Italy desperately needs to rejuvenate their your offensive line, and I think Caldara will be one of the players to be called up for the World Cup.
Excellent. I didn't mention Caldara, but I think you're really on to something. So the reason I wanted to have you on, aside from your expertise, is yesterday you sent me some great questions, so I figured you should just ask me on the podcast. So which ones did you have in mind when you think of these matches coming up?
Well, the first question was that is Ventura damned if you do and damned if you don't play the BBC? And then there's a follow-up question to that. Did he fail to rejuvenate the squad even before coming up to this point?
So, you know, my take on this round of selections and the fact that he's going back to the 3-5-2 and really going with the BBC, to me, it really, he's trying to be as cautious as possible and trying to, you know, do everything that people expect him the most and doing the things that have the less risk and maybe what exposes him the least to huge criticism if, God forbid, they don't make it. So I definitely think the way you described it, he's damned if you do, damned if you don't, with the BBC is spot on. I think he's almost forced to go with that. Very interestingly, both Matteo Bonetti and Adam Digby said that they'd probably start Rugani over Bonucci based on form. It was very interesting how when Matteo said it, no Milan fan really had much to say about that. The minute Adam sent it or said that, all hell broke loose. Not surprisingly, you can go back to the podcast we did with Dre Cordero, the first one, to see why. And the other part of the question that I really like, as you said, you know, he's going with a lot of older players. And, you know, when Ventura started with the Azzurri, he said, yeah, I'm going to rejuvenate the team and, you know, I'm going to really try to bring a youth movement. And I think your question's spot on. The fact that now he's going in a back-against-the-wall match without any of those things is a huge failure. So always great stuff for from you, Paolo. The last thing I want to ask you is, what's your prediction for tomorrow's match, and do you think Italy's going to get past this round?
I'm being optimistic. I hope there's an away goal, but I listened to your podcast with Nima, and I kind of end up agreeing with Nima that it's going to be a 0-0 draw, but I'm hoping that Italy can sneak out an away goal.
Awesome. Well, Paolo, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. Keep up the great work on the Marzo site. We're starting to get some rumors for the January window, so everyone follow Paolo, because become friends with him and he'll answer all your transfer questions. So thank you so much for joining us, my friend.
No problem, Dave. Have a good weekend.
Take care. Ciao. So I am thrilled today to be joined by Ben Golliver, who covers the NBA for Sports Illustrated, has a fantastic podcast called Open Floor, which he co-hosts with Andrew Sharp. And Ben was on one of our most popular episodes ever last summer. He happened to be on the day that Bonucci to Milan exploded, and I've been really looking forward to having him back on. And in the past few weeks, two things happened. I've been bombarded with questions from aspiring journalists, you know, asking me how they can break into the business. I guess people hear me and they're like, if this guy can do it, anyone can. And Ben, on his podcast, dropped a Bebeto reference, which I took as a bad signal that he wanted to come back on the podcast. So, Ben, we are thrilled to have you back on Calcioland. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, man. How's it going?
Doing great. Doing great. So, Ben, before we're definitely going to get into some NBA stuff because I have some questions on the season off to an amazing start. But I want to zero in a little bit more on what we chatted about last time you were on. And I definitely recommend to all the aspiring journalists to listen to that first podcast we did with Ben, because from my perspective, he's really embodied living the dream of being in the sports industry. Ben started mainly as a blogger out of Portland, really exploded, and now, you know, he's for the really cornerstone publication for sports here in the United States, Sports Illustrated, with Rob Mahoney, put him in charge of picking the top 100 players in the NBA year after year. So, Ben, give you know, our listeners who, like you, were starting as bloggers, what were the steps you took to go from becoming a blogger to really being a high-profile member of the mainstream media?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, I was all in. You know, I had a day job in marketing, kind of like recreational products, and I enjoyed it, but it wasn't necessarily my passion. Basketball was definitely my passion. I just kind of told myself, look, You know, you're kind of young in your early 20s. You don't have a lot else going on. You really love the sport, love the game, follow it religiously online. This can be something where, you know, you can scratch an itch, you know, writing, but then also, you know, if you stick at it after a while, maybe turn it into something. But I did not enter with the idea that it was going to be this huge career. And I think if you're trying to make it as an online writer for the money, just try something else. You know, it's got to be your love. Second thing I'd say is, you know, there's that old advice, like, you know, dress for the job you want.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like that with journalism, too. You know, just keep showing up. You know, if you want to be that, you know, beat writer type guy, if you want to be the trade analysis guy online, if you want to be the podcast host, I mean, the best thing you could do is just start doing it and get your repetitions and your practice in. I mean, for me, by the time I got a full-time, like, you know, job where I could sort of just not do anything else, that was in 2010 at CBS Sports. By that point, I had already probably covered at least 100 NBA games in person. And so in some of those situations, I'm kind of like paying for myself to go to those games, you know, on the press passes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's that level of sacrifice. So it's not glamorous. Don't do it for money. Don't do it for fame. Do it because you love it and jump in, you know, try to being at the building to me is huge. That's what I always tell everybody. If you're not in an NBA market, it's much easier if you move to an NBA market or you find a team that you can get to regularly. Otherwise, it's going to be tough to kind of build a network, whether it's sources or just other media people who can help sort of grow your profile. And then just show up, you know, prove to people that you're serious about it night in, night out, you know, do the job like a professional. And that's sort of how I got my start. You know, I basically just said, hey, I'm going to try to do this. I didn't have a big long-term master plan, kind of one step led to another. But the key to me really is passion, consistency, and then, you know, being face-to-face where you're a person, you're not just like a byline. The other thing I'd say too, and this is a simple one, write under your own name. You know, don't use a pseudonym, don't use something else, don't use a nickname. You know, have your Twitter handle be your first and last name.
Yep.
It's a small thing, but a lot of young people are kind of sometimes afraid to put themselves out there. I totally understand that. You got to get rid of those fears and own it. You know, you're going to be your byline for your entire career, so start from day one.
Yeah, great advice. It really covers so many of the suggestions that many of the other top writers we've had on the podcast have said. So, you know, nowadays with the technology and everything, you can do the job from day one. And I totally agree with everything you said. So one of the things you mentioned, one of the things you're really good at is grading trades in the NBA and transactions. I always enjoy getting your takes on them. Now, you know, I may not always agree, but you always back them up with a lot of good facts. But, you know, in this field, you know, specifically covering grading trades, there are so many people out there doing the exact same thing on the same transaction. So what's your approach with that? Do you not worry about what other people are writing? What do you go about trying to do something fresh and original? Or is that even something that you worry about?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that you think about when you're writing a trade grade, because those are sometimes some of the most viewed posts that you're going to write, because everybody's all in, from casual fans to diehards. And you have a lot of, you know, different, you know, bases to cover. I mean, on one hand, you have that casual fan who doesn't really pay attention, who says, hey, who's this new guy on my team? Is he any good? Should I be ranting about my general manager? So you want to kind of cover that casual fan. You've got the hardcore salary cap guys who want to know the financial implications. You've got the people who want to know the contract situations. You've got the hardcore people who always believe draft picks are more valuable than players. And so you kind of have to weigh, you know, those thoughts in. And then, of course, and I think the thing that gets a loss in a lot of other people's trade grade analysis is just sort of the context of the organization. And this is a philosophical debate I've had with some other people who do grades. I mean, a lot of people will just grade solely on the assets. You know, in other words, is player A more valuable than player B if they get traded for each other? To me, it's so important to look at like the context of an organization, recent history, their future outlook when you're looking at the motivations for the moves. And you know, the implications of those moves. So a great example would be like when Phil Jackson, you know, traded for Derrick Rose. I mean, what was the point of that move? It was so self-evidently bad. And so on the one hand, you're going to have those casual fans who are like, oh, I recognize Derrick Rose's name. On the other hand, you're going to have people who realize that, you know, Robin Lopez was probably the best player in that trade. Yeah. And you're going to have people who are saying, well, where are the Knicks going? How does Derrick Rose fit? And so you're trying to, you know, dabble in all of those areas when you're doing that initial trade grade, to just kind of, you know, check all those boxes. To me, the other key is just to be blunt, you know, and that might rub people the wrong way sometimes, you know, certainly kind of make some enemies. But if a guy can't play, a guy can't play. You should just say that in the trade. And if a GM is making a trade to save his job, you know, a good example of that would be like Rob Hennigan with the Serge Ibaka trade, you know, a couple of years ago when he goes all in on Ibaka. You need to mention in that deal, like this is a move of a desperate man. It's okay to say that. And I think in certain situations, people who are writing about these deals kind of you know, steer clear from that context, or steer clear from maybe chafing people who are involved in it. And so that's sort of what I see as my role. But look, nobody's perfect. I mean, that's another big thing too, is don't take the trade grades super seriously. I mean, you can never predict truly what's going to happen a year or 2 years down the line, and how badly they fail or how perfectly they succeed can sometimes have nothing to do with the initial trade itself.
Very, very interesting. So on your podcast recently, your co-host Andrew asked you to get into like your routine of what you do, you know, when you have to research an article, get ready for a podcast, or if you're covering a team out in LA. So I found this fascinating because you did a list of all the podcasts that you listen to, and I got into a lot of them. Some of them necessarily aren't sports related. It was a long list, very interesting there. So what I found fascinating is, you know, I always tell all the people that ask me, what do you need to do to get into this field? And I always say, you know, you need to become a subject matter expert in whatever you want to cover. And obviously URSI gives you some really important things to cover. So tell me a little bit how you use the podcasts that you listen to, the articles that you read, to kind of influence your work. I mean, I'm sure you're not taking their takes. I just wanted to take kind of a how you use that to prepare for your own work.
Yeah, I mean, I think you start with the games themselves, you know, and being an active watcher of the games. I mean, it's very easy, I think, especially for people who are used and grew up on social media, to just look at the social media and see what people are saying. I mean, I think it's more valuable for a writer, especially if you're going to be writing full-length columns, to go to the original source material, which would be the games themselves, and then also what are the players saying. So I pretty religiously, you know, track both, you know, I try to watch like three games in full every single day, basically, if I can. You know, 7 days a week. And so that's step one. Step two would be to really stay up on what are the players, executives, and other sort of, you know, established media members saying about what's happening on the court. After you do it for 10 years, you know, I'm feeling pretty old, but you get pretty good at reading between the lines sometimes and kind of guessing what a player means based on how he's saying it. That's kind of an acquired skill. And I think, you know, certainly that's something that I had to learn. You know, when I first started and I was like in a locker room, I was just like transcribing and just basically like a receptionist dictating every single word a player would say and taking it at 100% face value. And you do learn pretty quickly that, you know, people might lie to you. People might hide their true intentions. People might be willing to say something off the record to somebody they trust, as opposed to on the record to a group of media members, especially one that might have cameras in their face. So you go through that process. Also, I think you need to consult, you know, statistics on a regular basis. I mean, to me, that's a big part of it. So, you know, that means diving into lineup data. That means looking at the most efficient players, the players with the best impact stats, just being really comfortable and familiar with that. Another thing that I try to do is just have conversations with people, whether they're in the league or media members, to just kind of stay up. What are people talking about? What are people looking for? But I think it's a different task if you're writing versus if you're doing a podcast. This is something that I kind of had to learn. I mean, you could probably tell it's a little bit of work for me to try to be funny or entertaining or whatever. Like my natural default setting is sort of, you know, dry and maybe a little sarcastic, but kind of logical. On podcasts, it's all about the entertainment factor, the personality, you know, being funny, making a point that is humorous. I think sticks with people on a podcast much better than making a point by blowing them away with numbers, right? And I think to a certain degree, that's why guys like Charles Barkley and Shaq are some of the most famous basketball analysts out there, even if there's a lot of people who are on social media all day long nitpicking what they're actually saying. Part of the reason why they are so influential as voices is because they're very well-honed comedians. And, you know, they kind of buy into their own shtick. And I think that's part of it on being on a podcast. For writing, that's, I think, to me, a lot less important. You can just, you know, write in your own voice. And so I think that's sort of how I prepare. I mean, I try to have a nice balance in my life, too. You know, you don't want to be all basketball all the time. So you do want to listen what's going on, you know, whether it's politics, current events, other sports. That's something, again, I had to learn. You know, I was completely obsessed with the NBA and, you know, nothing else for a good solid 5 or 6 years. I think that does lead a little bit to tunnel vision and groupthink. It's better to think outside the box. And then my final thing I'd say is just, you know, take some time to think every day. You know, step away from the computer, put the phone down, process everything that you've watched, everything you've read, process what other people are saying, whether it's on Twitter or their columns, and try to find something that hasn't been said yet and say that. And, you know, that's one thing I was trying to do, like with the LeBron column last week is, you know, everyone's talking about Cleveland's early struggles. But to me, like, what's the most important takeaway? The fact that they're not playing defense in October, which we expected, or the fact that their weaknesses are things LeBron should be looking to fix with his next decision, right? Like, there's a lot of things structurally and organization-wise with the Cavaliers that may never get fixed because of the personalities who are there, whether it's the owner, the first-time GM, or the coach who kind of took over in strange circumstances. Are there other organizations out there, whether it's the Spurs or the Rockets or some other places that might provide more structure for LeBron next year so he doesn't have to go through some of these early struggles, so he doesn't have to play so many minutes? And to me, I didn't necessarily see anyone else making those kinds of arguments. Maybe it's a little bit early to make those arguments, but that was like, you know, an example where I'm aware of everything that people are saying out there, and I'm kind of trying to take my own path to reach conclusions and make arguments that maybe nobody else is making.
Very interesting. I can relate a lot to that. I know you're really into nature walks, getting out, and that's something that I do as much as possible well before I write or get the pod. I think that really helps. So let's jump into the league, and I wanted to ask you about two players that you've been on their bandwagon for quite some time, and they're really blowing up. Now, the first one is Giannis Antetokounmpo on Milwaukee. This year, I think he's second in scoring in the NBA right now, taken a huge leap in the past 2 years. He's really become one of the most prominent names in the NBA. And what I find really interesting about him is we've seen, you know, a lot of big stars like Paul George and Kevin Durant leave the smaller markets with an eye towards maybe playing in a bigger market, Paul George, maybe a year from now. But at the same time, the NBA is doing a lot to make it easier for teams that draft a great player like Milwaukee did with him to keep him. So where do you see the future for him? There's a lot of players that now decide their future, kind of call their shots, get together with their friends. Do you see Giannis staying more in Milwaukee long term, or will he be one of those stars that decides to leave for a bigger market?
Well, it really seems to me, from everything that he said and everything he's sort of trying to present, is that he's still in that honeymoon phase with the Bucks, where he's still kind of pinching himself. He can't believe that he, you know, got a $100 million deal. He can't even believe necessarily that he's in the NBA. And from my experience as a writer, the honeymoon never lasts forever, right? I mean, at some point, guys who are as talented as Giannis, who are, you know, potentially top five talents in the league, they have to win or they get unsatisfied. It's just, there's no way around that. I think before we have that conversation about does Giannis force his way out to a big market, though, there's some other steps involved. And we're seeing this play out, especially recently too, where star players can help make personnel decisions. You know, how many guys has LeBron got to his team over the last 5 years? I mean, countless. We couldn't even name all of them. And also, you know, a tried and true one would be the coaching situation. I mean, I look at Giannis, to me, he's being held back by Milwaukee's offense. They are not playing up and down. They do not surround him with very creative lineups. Part of the problem is that they're not super deep, but another part of the problem is that they're built to play, you know, bigs, traditional bigs, more often than a lot of other teams are. And the ideal situation for Giannis is that you just clear the paint out, you let him go one-on-one, and nobody can stop him in that situation. They get there sometimes, but not all the time. And I think a lot of Giannis's success early in this season has happened in spite of the offense rather than because of the offense. And to me, that's a problem. And so that's one thing I'd be looking at here shorter term before we get to the free agency speculation with Giannis is, you know, what's Jason Kidd's future in Milwaukee? And if he's no longer going to be the coach long term, you know, what kind of a coach would you bring in there to bring the most out of Giannis's game and kind of cater to him? You know, again, that could be something that doesn't get resolved until next year. But that this is a franchise at this point of Giannis's career that it should have real expectations. You know, they can't be okay being under 500. This is a team that needs to win 45, 50 games this season and win a playoff series. I mean, Giannis is at that stage, especially in the Eastern Conference, where it's kind of put up or shut up time. And so I think it will unfold here over the next couple of years. I think that he is still so grateful to the Bucks for taking him in the first place, taking a chance on him and empowering him when he was a young player. I mean, really giving him a meaningful role right from the get-go, that there is going to be more loyalty than usual for a player of his stature. But they've got to make progress with the roster around him. You know, find more wings, 3-and-D guys who can play that interchangeable style. He's awesome when he gets to play with Chris Middleton. He needs a little extra help. And then also I think they need to get more creative offensively. It just bogs down too much ISO stuff one-on-one and too much burden on Giannis by himself. So we'll see. But I think we should hold that speculation stuff till at least like 2019.
Very interesting. So another player that you've been pushing for a while, and we almost forget that he's a rookie now, is Ben Simmons, sat out all of last season. And, you know, I watched him a few times on TV, and I was watching, you know, Isaiah Thomas, not the one that the Celtics traded to Cleveland, but the Isaiah Thomas that played for the Pistons, who went as far as saying that he could see him turn into a player like Magic Johnson, which, you know, if I read that on Twitter, I'd be like, yeah, whatever. But when it's a player, an old school player that played with Magic, that tells me a lot. So tell me a little bit what you saw in Ben Simmons and what you think the ceiling is for him.
Well, I don't think the Magic comparison is fair because what we have today is a lot of guys that size, you know, 6'9", 6'10", who are capable of running an offense, handling the ball and making passes, whether it's LeBron, whether it's Giannis, whether it's Simmons. And, you know, you could probably add a few other names to that mix. I mean, it's a slightly different mold, but even like Blake Griffin and Draymond are very skilled passers, very skilled playmakers for their teammates at a big size. So part of the allure and the amazing, you know, historical, you know, kind of stature of Magic Johnson was that Magic, there was one Magic. There wasn't five guys who are sort of fitting this same mold, right? Like Magic was the only guy who was sort of playing that way at his size back in the 80s. And so, you know, Magic right now, frankly, looks like 30 years ahead of his time, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, he really looks like even better to me in historical hindsight. So I don't love that comparison for Ben Simmons or really for any player. I mean, Ben Simmons isn't doing anything 30 years ahead of his time. So I think we can kind of, you know, move past that. At the same moment, to me, I mean, Ben Simmons can be a Hall of Famer. I mean, this is a guy who can be a 10-time All-Star player. I think he's going to be in the All-Star conversation this year as a rookie, or kind of a redshirt rookie, if you want to call him that. That's impressive. I think he has had the kind of offensive impact I expected. The first time I saw him, I believe he was a junior in high school. And at the time, Wiggins and Jabari Parker were sort of getting a lot of hype. And my initial just gut reaction was, this guy's a lot better than both those players right now. And it's been a long road to kind of see it. You know, I mean, he didn't play in the NCAA tournament. He's gone for an entire year. He misses his second summer league. So we're just sitting there anticipating, waiting. I think his comeback and his immediate impact is one of the best stories the NBA has here in the first couple of weeks. You really couldn't ask for a better start to his career, you know, this season than he's had. And, you know, he's kind of hitting the ground running sort of like I expected. But, you know, there's still a gap between like Hall of Famer, 10-time All-Star, and Magic. And I think let's give Magic his due, you know?
Absolutely. So the last player I wanted to ask you about is Lonzo Ball. I know you cover the Lakers quite a bit, but more than Lonzo, also the influence of his dad, LeVar. Like, I think now we live in a culture that, you know, has elected Donald Trump president. Maybe LeVar Ball isn't as crazy as people think. Maybe he knows exactly what he's doing in a lot of ways in this culture. So tell me about your whole take on Lonzo as a player and how far you think he can go, and if you think LeVar is ever going to get to the point where the Lakers, maybe the NBA as a whole, are going to have to step in as far as him taunting, you know, other NBA players, and in a lot of ways not making necessarily easy for his son to succeed.
Well, I would say there's already been progress in sort of narrowing LeVar's influence. I mean, if you remember back to Summer League, he said some really wild stuff. Like, I was there in Las Vegas kind of interviewing him, and he was saying, well, this is the worst game Lonzo's ever played. Another time he told me, hey, look, Lonzo had a triple-double, but it doesn't matter because they lost. I mean, he was really saying the kinds of things a coach who's angry, like a Stan Van Gundy type coach, would say after a game about players. And to me, that is destructive. That is a serious distraction. If LeVar is just kind of, you know, going back and forth with Marcin Gortat over, oh, my team's better, your team's better, I mean, that kind of banter on Twitter is not as serious of a distraction to me. Because first of all, Lonzo doesn't care about any of it. He's like the most even-keeled, laid-back person. You wouldn't even be able to kind of tell that there's this huge, you know, family drama around him. I mean, if you just look at him and watch him play. But you don't want LeVar as like a surrogate coach, right? And there's this all this thing, oh, he's going to take his other son out of his high school. He's going to homeschool him. There was some kind of clashes back and forth with coaching staffs, whether at Chino Hills High School or UCLA basketball. That's the stuff you want to avoid. And I think so far, correct me if I'm wrong, that really has not been an issue with the Lakers. And at the same time, the Lakers are off to not the world's worst start. I mean, we're talking here on Monday, they're 4-5. And Lonzo really hasn't even played that well yet. So you could say maybe they're slightly ahead of expectations. They certainly look more respectable than they did last year. Their team culture seems better than it was last year. And I think some of that is like Brandon Ingram taking, you know, a pretty noticeable step forward. I think a guy like Brooke Lopez just adds a professionalism and a competence that they were lacking last year. Kyle Kuzma has been sort of like, you know, found money. I mean, just, you know, incredible late first round draft pick. And you throw on top of that Lonzo kind of, you know, picking and choosing his spots and making an impact, but also really reinforcing the type and style of pace that Luke Walton's wanted to play. All those things are kind of positive indicators. And I don't really see LeVar's fingerprints on any of that stuff. So for the Lakers, when I look at sort of the post-Kobe era, this is the brightest moment to me that they've had, I think, and it's not particularly close. I mean, there were some pretty dark times, whether it was Kobe's last season or the immediate aftermath, where, you know, I'm not out here saying, oh, L.A. is going to be the destination that lands Paul George and LeBron next summer. I'm not going that optimistic, but I am saying that their young players are playing pretty well, and the LeVar thing really hasn't cast that much of a shadow. I mean, it still is going to guarantee draw, you know, social media commentary, you know, day in, day out. I mean, he's just a ratings machine. There's no question. But I think he's done a pretty good job of sort of, you know, staying inside the lines in terms of what he should be discussing and what he shouldn't be.
Excellent. Well, listen, Ben, I really want to thank you for coming on. Your insight in NBA, of course, is amazing. Check out Ben's recent column on LeBron James. I cannot recommend enough his podcast, Open Floor. And thank you so much for sharing your insight. For a young journalist, is really welcomed and fantastic. So thank you again for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, man. Take care.
Awesome.